Hello, folks. I think we're going to get started and people can trickle in. No pun intended. So we've got a pretty great panel in store, I think, today about water scarcity and privatization and price and what's happening on the ground here in Texas and beyond. My name is Matthew Frank, and I'm a reporter from Missoula, Montana, and I'm very grateful to be accompanied today by three experts on water issues in Texas and elsewhere. To my left here is Ken Rainwater, and Ken is the director of the Water Resources Center at Texas Tech. Next to Ken is David Sandino, and David is the director of the Center for Water Law and Policy at Texas Tech, and also until 2010, he was the chief counsel for the California Department of Water Resources. And finally, we have Mike McGregor, who represents the High Plains Underground Water Conservation District. So thanks to all of you for coming. Really appreciate it. We're going to start with a couple presentations by Ken and David, and then go from there. So thanks for coming, guys.
All right. Thank you, Matt. And I guess I'll be going through this presentation here. If you want to just go and get it over with, my name really is Ken Rainwater, and I do work at the Water Resources Center at Texas Tech. It's just my name, and it just turned out that way. I actually come from a long line of auto mechanics, not hydrologists, but there's water in every car as far as I know, right? Except maybe that one outside. So as we were trying to plan what to start with here, we didn't know what the audience would be like, but in order to get from one place to the other, we decided to lay out some information for you for kind of common ground that maybe will feed other questions and comments that you have for us to deal with. I put this presentation together a few months ago for something called the Texas Lyceum that meets once or twice a year and tries to grow up our future politicians, essentially. So this was originally intended for people that had political aspirations, so I don't know how to compare their scientific background to yours. I'll let you be the judge because you guys deal with those people all the time. All right. But I'm just calling this Hydrology 101 Texas style just to give you an idea about how water is distributed across this big state, and we'll end up with something about the differences in what we pay for it across the state. Hey, first off, you guys have all seen the hydrologic cycle all the way back to grade school, right? Where, for example, we talk about the water coming up from evaporation into the clouds move over the land, we have rainfall, we can have runoff that finds its way into our streams and lakes, we can also have the water percolate down into our aquifers and have it available as groundwater, and the groundwater then can also flow to the ocean, have different paths for water, different forms, whether it's in vapor or liquid form, it could be snow as well. And we have different times of travel and residence along the way in the hydrologic cycle. Sometimes in our aquifers, the water can be there many millions of years in terms of the time that it's there, whereas in our lakes and rivers, it may be fractions of a year. So that affects things about its quantity, quality, and its availability to us. You probably have heard about the hydrologic cycle, too, haven't you? We all already quoted that already. If you haven't seen that, just remind ourselves. Typically, maybe Americans and Texans are different. We are largely motivated by crises. Are there any other societies that are different than that? You know, something bad has to happen for us to want to do something about it. So in water, we can have these two extremes. Mostly we've been talking about drought here, but floods can happen as well. When a flood or a drought happens, usually that means we have to think about the next answer. So we talk about planning studies, and I stand self-convicted here as a civil engineer because we're the kind of people that help with planning studies with hydrogeologists and hydrologists and politicians and attorneys to what are our choices, what can we do. Usually by the time we figure out what we can do and we have some alternatives, it always costs more than we thought it would. I told you I grew up in a family of auto mechanics. That's one business that's the same way, right? If something's wrong with your car, it always costs more than you thought it would. And it may not make you feel better if they give you the broken part, but I would just say, for me, if you would forgive your auto mechanics from here on, I would appreciate that because they had to send their kids to school too. But sticker shock is something that gets us because it's going to cost money. There's capital. There's operation and maintenance. What are we going to do? So being normal human beings, what typically happens after that is we decide we need to think about it. And so procrastination, putting it off, because typically by the time the planning study has actually begun, the flood has subsided. It may be longer, but the drought, it may have rained. And so things may have changed there. And sadly, I bet we all have anecdotal proof that occasionally procrastination does pay off. Right? Or is it just me? So that means that leads us back to the next occurrence of the crisis. So this is a challenge. This is kind of funny, and I didn't invent this, but this is part of the reality that we deal with. As we look at how water varies across the state, one of the first things just sort of, we're not like just bragging that Texas is big. It's also a challenge for us. It's part of our struggle, you know, that we are not a monoculture by any means, and we have different issues in different parts of the state, but we share resources, both financial and natural. And so, for example, here, this is a map that shows the distribution of rainfall that tends to happen each year, average annual rainfall across the state. Okay, we're up here in Lubbock, about right there, I think, in Lubbock County, where our average rainfall is 18 to 20 inches per year. If we get out to far west Texas, El Paso, and places like where I grew up, it can be under 14 inches per year. If we get all the way over here to the Sabine River on the eastern boundary of the state, we can be above 54 inches a year. So the average rainfall varies across the state by a factor of almost four, just the average. Then the amount of rainfall that we can get in any given year at a point can vary easily by a factor of two or more. The average rainfall here is about 20 inches per year. Just a few years ago, we had 40 inches in 1 year. Last year, we had less than 6 inches in 1 year. So that sort of variation happens of our part of the climate. When people think about water resources, typically the first thing we think about is the water we can see. And so we think about the water in rivers and lakes, and that's kind of our favorite water. The way we do water planning in Texas is we kind of look first at river basins that exist in different parts of the state. And so this is a map that shows about 23 different river basins from the Rio Grande on the western side, our boundary with Mexico, to the Sabine River on the other side in East Texas, and includes the Red River, the boundary between us and Oklahoma, and then we have many rivers in Texas. Most of our rivers start in Texas. A few of them start in New Mexico or come to us from Oklahoma, so we have many different river basins. Now, just quickly want to show you about how the rivers and the reservoirs connect to the basins. So this is just another map showing the distribution of the river basins. If we put on the major rivers that define the ones, the 23 that give the names, then those blue lines give us those 23 rivers. Then if we add in the reservoirs that we have in Texas, we add in those splotches. You may have already heard, since you've been here in Texas, we only have one natural lake. Y'all know which one that is? It's a long way from here. It's Caddo Lake in East Texas, almost to Louisiana. All the rest of the reservoirs we have are man-made. And you'll notice that the reservoirs, some of them showed up on the rivers, some didn't, because they're on smaller rivers that lead to those other major rivers elsewhere. Also, I could throw on the map to show you that this isn't necessarily where the people live, because, so we often have pipelines and canals and other transmissive devices, I guess, to get the water from one place to the other. So in terms of surface water, as we use it, we like surface water because we see it as a renewable water resource. It's always going to rain again, isn't it? And so we like that because we have also seen the rivers go up and down, the lakes go up and down, so we're comfortable often with that variability within some range. If the river flows year-round, that means groundwater is feeding it somewhere upstream. So spring flow provides base flow in Texas. We don't have much snow melt feeding of our rivers here. Rainfall does add more flow and leads to the other variations. We collect these variations in our reservoirs to allow us to have water for the long-term use rather than just catching when it comes by. And those reservoirs have multiple purposes, for example, for flood control, water supply, recreation, navigation. Now, pretty much every lake's for recreation, right? But then the other purposes also show up. We have some, and sometimes it bothers people when a reservoir that's built for flood control isn't available for water supply. We also have water quality variations as we go from one surface water to the next. The Pecos River, when it comes to us from New Mexico, already has about 8,000 parts per million total dissolved solids. It's not a It just is a salty river, whereas some of our other rivers have a better quality in different places. There are natural cycles in terms of the water quality variations during the seasons and over longer periods. And then our rivers include some treated wastewater effluent flow. In order for the water rights downstream to be served, we have to provide some return of water from our cities next to the rivers so that water would be available. So one of the things we say, well, it depends on where you are, but we say things like Houston drinks what Dallas flushes. So from Trinity River, things like that. But it's, again, there are treatment plants involved in both cases. When we talk about groundwater in the state of Texas, we have 9 major aquifers that are spread across the state. Up here where we are is the blue is the Ogallala that you've heard a lot about. We have the Hueco Bolson aquifer out in El Paso. There's the Pecos Alluvium here, the Edwards Trinity aquifer down here, Carrizo Wilcox, the Gulf Coast, several different major aquifers across the state. Now you notice as you go across the state there are still many counties. We have 254 of them. I don't know why the geometry of the counties is a whole other story. Up here, they're nice little squares and rectangles. Other places where we have other political reasons. But you'll notice we have big white splotches in here with no major aquifer. So that's just something to keep in mind. We have 21 minor aquifers. These are aquifers that are less than 18 years old. Not really. They are seen as less useful because of their extent or their quality. And many of these have brackish or saltier water, or they are there are other geologic reasons to make them minor. And so there are 21 of these across the state. For example, where we are here, we have the Edwards Trinity High Plains beneath the Ogallala, which is actually tapped by most of our water wells where those are, because the drillers go ahead and drill through both of them, get all the water they can. We have the Santa Rosa or Adakum aquifer beneath that has brackish water and sometimes fresh water in places. The Capitan Reef water here is a big deal. If y'all were in Odessa yesterday, you heard about that one. And so there's other, the Bone Springs is over there, other different minor aquifers. Again, you'll still notice there's still many counties that don't have groundwater access. So groundwater issues, typically we have water quality variations within an aquifer and from aquifer to aquifer. They're not just big bathtubs of continuous, constant quality water. Some are fresh, some are brackish, and you're all familiar with the term brackish. It's just another word for salty, but we have to use jargon so that people will hire us to define the words, right? That's just part of the deal that we have. Not something else in our neighborhood up in this part of the High Plains, in terms of the things that make water have some dissolved solids in them, some of these are affected by our drinking water standards, our maximum contaminant levels. A big concern here in the southern High Plains is arsenic. Until 2007, a drinking water standard was 50 parts per billion, and all our drinking water from the Ogallala was okay. Starting in 2007, the drinking water standard dropped to 10 parts per billion, and the average arsenic concentration in the southern High Plains part of the Ogallala is about 15 to 20. So we went from safe to unsafe legally in a matter of a day. So those cities are going to have to do something about that eventually. We have high fluoride in our water, high enough that those of us born out here and drink the water learn to smile with our mouths shut. Now, again, the city of Lubbock's water that you've been drinking does not have that problem. The fluoride's just right in the water that we use here. But in the southern part of the southern High Plains, we have fluoride above 4 parts per million. You may have heard concerns about perchlorate around the country. That's a contaminant from rocket fuels that were used in the military-industrial complex, and there's a lot of concerns about cleaning that up in California. Well, we actually didn't ever look for perchlorate until the 90s, and we were just barely able to measure it, and people said we needed to clean it up. So what should we clean it up to? It's hard to clean up anything in the environment to zero. And we've been involved in a lot of research here at Texas Tech, and we found that perchlorate is actually in the natural hydrologic cycle. It's in rainfall. It's in glaciers. It's in groundwater. It's in the things that get irrigated with that groundwater. It's in wine. It's in lettuce. So the EPA has struggled mightily with setting a MCL for that, but we have some of that around here as well. Another thing that you've heard about a lot, and we don't have to say as much about here unless you ask more questions, is that the recharge rate to our aquifers determines the, I'm using the term renewability. I want to stay away from sustainability because I think if people are armed, we could have deaths. But in terms of how does the, although I like things to be sustainable if possible, but people argue about that, and life's too short for me today. So in terms of how water gets back in the aquifer, the deposits that are made to that checking account, it can really vary depending on the local geology. The Edwards Aquifer that we have in the San Antonio area is a karstic aquifer. It's like those of you that went to the Carlsbad Caverns and walked around the caverns, we got a lot of caverns in that part of the world in central Texas. You can have a flash flood in that part of Texas, and the water levels in those wells will rise tens of feet overnight because it's like a buried pipe system. We just don't know where all the pipes are, but it responds very quickly. The Ogallala that we live on here, the recharge rate is much slower than it is down there because we have a different geologic material, and so it's a challenge to recognize those numbers. The main thing, though, as you've learned with your checking account, or does anybody have a checking account anymore? Okay, is that, if you write more checks than you do deposits, and it's not the number of checks, right, it's the amounts on them, then your balance goes down. And it's the same thing that happens with our aquifers as well. So we need to think about how we want to manage that. One thing I do want to mention just a little bit, sometimes people have, this is my Boone Pickens slide. You know, Boone Pickens, when he started talking about wanted to sell water in Roberts County, talked about the law of the biggest straw, and he implied that if somebody stuck in a groundwater well in Roberts County, they would immediately remove all the water under his property. That just wasn't quite exactly right. But I do want to at least try to qualitatively represent a couple of things about water and aquifers. First off, I can't draw the picture right. Because actually for a typical aquifer we have, like the Ogallala here, there is a porous medium here. There are particles of geologic material that the water lives between. But if I drew those, you couldn't see the water. So can you visualize with me, this is kind of like this is soil that has water inside of it. Or if it helps better, think about a sponge that has openings inside of it. It has porosity that the water can flow through. In addition, for aquifers, they're not just horizontal layer cake lines. The bottom of the aquifer has some sort of shape based on the geologic processes that led to its being there. Then the geologic material on top of it has some sort of topography at its top, and then the geologic material in here doesn't all have to be the same stuff. So there are variations in terms of how easily water can move through the subsurface. In addition, because of the topography at the surface, occasionally the water in our aquifers can meet our surface water bodies. The way I've drawn the picture here, the blue represents the part of the aquifer that is saturated with water. And civil engineering language to show where the water table is, or the top of that zone of saturation, is to draw an upside-down triangle on it. I'll give you that one for free. You didn't have to pay for that one. Okay? So the way it's drawn here, the water level is higher on the left, gets lower to the right. My students all like the water to flow from left to right in class. And so the water flows from high head to low head, and so it would be flowing from left to right within the aquifer. Eventually, where the aquifer and the water table meet the land surface, this would be a place where the water would be coming from the aquifer into the stream, so we would be a gaining stream. These other lines I have here represent wells in the aquifer, and so there's two deep ones and one shallow one. Right now, nobody's pumping anything. If I turn on two of the wells, the two deeper ones, and that's what I'm trying to I messed up. Sorry.
Fine.
I used to know how to do a Mac back when they were little and crashed every 30 seconds. So these upward arrows represent pumping at these two wells. When we pump at a well, we cause what's called drawdown. In order to get the flow to come toward the well, we have to lower the head, the saturated thickness at the well, so the water flows to it. So we see those shapes at these two wells here. There's drawdown here. There's drawdown at this well. So that in general, we still have flow going from left to right, but near the wells, we can reverse the flow for a little bit around that well to cause local production. You'll notice that these two wells, the water levels are down. Nothing's happened at the middle one yet. Nothing's happened at the stream yet. If we pump for a long time or for a high enough rate, and so I've made the arrows larger, eventually we can cause the water level to go down if we're pumping the water out faster than it is being replenished or flowing through the system. So my drawdown zones here narrow. My pumping wells are larger and deeper than they used to be, and also there's the possibility of drawing down the water in the aquifer far enough that the guy with the short well doesn't have access anymore. In addition, if we draw the water down far enough, we can stop the spring flow that happened to the river. So that's what I'm trying to show with that. Does that kind of help you visualize how things work in an aquifer? We can't really see the water flow the same way, but this is how things work. Okay, another thing I just want to mention, too, in terms of groundwater issues and how we deal with them, and Mike will can say much more to this, just since I had a chance to show you a colorful picture I wanted to. Texas has 254 counties in it, and the primary organizations for local control of groundwater issues are groundwater conservation districts. Right now, we have 99 of them. The oldest and largest one is right here where we live. All are parts of 16 counties for the High Plains Underground Water Conservation District. We have some other large districts to the north of us. Most of the other districts, though, are the size of a county or less in terms of their existence. So each of those districts gets to work with its own set of requirements for reporting and rules. They all have the interest of trying to conserve the water and educate the owners of the water and how it's used. But I'll just let our other panelists talk more about this later. Challenges that we have for the counter conservation districts, well, I guess I'm going to say more than I thought I was. First off is education of the groundwater owners. One of the things they typically encourage people to do is to put their wells far enough apart so that if one guy's pumping, he doesn't hurt the guy next to him very much. Also, they try to educate them about the overall depletion in the aquifer that might be happening and the pumping distribution. They provide maps that describe the changes in water stored, and they're always great sources of information for best practices for use in conservation. One of the things, though, we have to recognize is the groundwater conservation districts no one of them owns all of a single aquifer. All the aquifers are shared. So they're concerned for future conditions that are handled through our regional planning processes and through the groundwater management areas. There are uncertainties about recharge. And how does the water interact with surface water? It's hard for us to describe that accurately mathematically, so we struggle with that. As we showed, there are some areas that aren't in the groundwater conservation districts yet, and then the Water Development Board and the TCEQ have encouraged the creation of groundwater management areas that combine several groundwater conservation districts over aquifers. And we'll kind of look at this now. This is our groundwater management areas that have been identified by the state. Notice there are 16 of them. Number one up there in the panhandle, we're in number two here, and they're different districts, and you know, sometimes they follow the county boundaries, sometimes they don't, and the reason for that is they're attempting to try to make it look like the major and minor aquifer map. So that is a big step forward, I think, in what the agencies and the districts have combined to work toward, is even though we might have separate legal jurisdictions, that we do recognize that there is a better agreement with at least the major aquifers for this purpose. My last topic is talk a little bit about paying for water, since this is supposed to be about financial issues as well. Municipalities have to set their rates for the water, and when they do that, they use staff and consultants to study the cost, and then, of course, the elected officials have to approve that. Now, if things are going well, who gets the credit in the municipality? The elected officials, right? If things are going bad, who gets blamed? Other people. So one of the challenges we have in terms of it is we have to maintain our existing infrastructure, and if our city wants to grow, we may need to build some new stuff and may have new operational costs. So the reality is water is only going to get more expensive typically over time as we deal with that in the U.S. Some people get mad because they say, well, electronics gets cheaper. You know, my computer costs less than it did last time, but didn't you just buy that last computer a couple of years ago? How often do we get to buy a new water system for a city? You know, that's a very different time frame in terms of those issues. When people look at our water rates, there's a couple of components in terms of, first, our meter or connection rate. Just to be in the game, we have to pay. It depends on how big our meter is, and I'm comparing the one-inch meter size. It's kind of the second size for most meters. Start off at 3/4, get a little bigger. The cheapest one rate is in Houston, which is $4.94 for a one-inch meter. The most expensive one is we're number one here in Lubbock, at least until next month. The mayor wants to change this. Our connection rate for a one-inch meter is $43 a month. Then there's a use rate that is either in dollars per 1,000 gallons, that's what they used to do, and now there's something called dollars per CCF. That's per 1,000 cubic feet, or 100 cubic feet. I always get that wrong, C like centimeter, 100 cubic feet. That's 743 gallons, approximately, or 748. The reason for that is that was a way that you could keep the rate the same but sell people less water, and they didn't think their rates went up. I think that's what they meant. The rates and calculations vary widely across the state. Ooh, that's not the way that was supposed to come out, but it looks pretty cool. All right. This is a comparison of the monthly water rates in smaller Texas cities from Littlefield to Leveland, Stanton, Monahan, Snyder, Sweetwater, a great name for water. And you'll see that we have on the horizontal axis gallons of water used, 0 to 20,000, cost, 0 to $150 per month. Typical average water use rates are on the order of maybe 5 to 7,000 gallons a month for most homeowners. So typically you see for these small cities, there's a big range. If you're in that 7,000 gallon range, you might pay anywhere from $20 to $50 a month in these smaller cities. If you go to larger, BC didn't and Mac didn't get along as well together on that. I don't know what to say. Look good on my computer. But this is the larger cities, and I can make a better version of this available if necessary. The same range, 0 to 20,000 gallons per month and 0 to 200 gallons of water here. Here's the Lubbock line, way up here, the purple for the 1 inch. And then we have other cities like San Antonio, Dallas, Houston, other ones shown. Still in that $7,000 range, we can still range from about $20 or $30 a month up to as high as $60 a month for the big cities. So the perspective for this, what I'd like to leave you with, is that when we think about our monthly water bill, it bothers people if they've seen it change. And they get upset about it. But currently, and I'm not saying this is a reason to not be upset, but if we compare the cost of water, our monthly water bills, even at the biggest one, are close to what we pay for a tank of gas. We don't get to vote on gas prices. It's hard to yell at those people. Do you yell at the people at the self-serve station? Yeah, they're not going to do anything about it, right? We elect our municipal decision makers, and those essential services cost money, but we struggle with what we think things should cost. I don't know what y'all think in other states, but in Texas, everybody thinks government and everything should cost less money, and it doesn't always work. Our main choice is if we want to pay less, we want to use less. That's really our choice. Our cities have rationing policies, and we have landscaping and plumbing choices and those kind of things, so that's an important thing for us to keep in mind. All right, that's what I got.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, good afternoon, and thank you for attending our panel. Especially thankful because it's Friday afternoon and after lunch, and there's nice weather out there. So I also should apologize before I get started. I don't like making presentations while I'm sitting down. I feel like I should use my hands and feel like I'm in a straitjacket right here, but I'll do my best and see if I can overcome this limitation that I have. My presentation today is going to pick up on the topic relating to the privatization of water. And from my standpoint, there's two big components to the privatization of water. One is discussed in the brochure in detail, where private companies are taking over typically government-run water agencies to supply water. That's one issue relating to privatization, and it's an important one, but I'm not talking about that. What I'm going to talk about is, I think, a more fundamental issue relating to the public-private concept relating to water, and that is, who owns the water? Is water a commodity that is owned, capable of being owned by private citizens, corporations, or is water different? Is water that is something that's owned by the public? And since I'm an attorney, I'm going to come about this through a legal analysis, but I'm going to try to give you the policy implications. I'm excited about talking about this topic because I think it's the greatest story that's going on in the West right now. It's a regional story, but I think it's going to spread to the East at some point. And it's going on in Texas, and I'll end my presentation with a talk about Texas. So here's a summary of my presentation. I'm going to cover the dual nature of water, whether it can be owned privately or publicly or both. I'm also going to talk a little bit about the tension that occurs because of the regulatory nature of governmental agencies and their review of water and when it conflicts with property rights. And these conflicts now are being sorted out by the courts in a variety of states, in a variety of forums, and they have, I think, some big implications in terms of how water is managed for environmental protection. So that's what I'm going to cover. And and this will pick up, too, I think, the strain of the environmental movement as it conflicts with the property rights movement and the tensions associated with the two. So by way of background, I'm going to cover my entire semester of water law in the next 10 seconds. I'm going to cover how water is allocated in the West. And this is most of the states that are west of the 100th meridian have an allocation system. By allocation, how do we divide up surface water? And we do it through a system that is developed over 100 years called the appropriative system. Doesn't matter where you are in the West, Texas, New Mexico, California. This is the system. And the system has a fundamental component, and that is that water is divided up based on priority. So if there's 10 water users in a system on a river, they're all diverting, they all have a straw, a Ken straw in the groundwater, a pump in the surface water, that if they're taking water out of that system, it's based on who puts the straw in first. And if there's not enough water to go around, the users that are in the system first, they're protected. The users that come later, they have to curtail their water use. That's how it works in theory. They actually give names. The water users that are in the system first are called senior users. Water users that come in later are called junior users. If you have a senior water right, you're in great shape. If you have a junior water right, not so good, because when you have a dry year, there's a good chance you're going to get a notice that you have to curtail your diversion. And this is the case in all the western states. Very similar system. And what the states have done, including Texas, they've set up a state agency that administers this system to award permitted water rights and also to submit to send curtailment notices when there's not enough water to go around. This developed over time, but every state has an agency that supervises water rights in the West. I'll point out, too, and I'll get to groundwater later. Ken did a great job describing groundwater as a resource. I'm going to talk a little bit at the end about how groundwater is managed, and its regulatory system is different than surface water. Okay, so that's how we happily proceeded in the West for 100 years, and then all of a sudden we have a new regulatory system that overlaps the traditional state's water rights appropriative system, and this is the Endangered Species Act, and this is what created the conflict between water as a public resource and as private water rights. I'll try to make this dramatic, but the Endangered Species Act has come in and has shifted how we look at water, and I call it the new sheriff in town. For those of you that have not spent a lot of time with the Endangered Species Act, I believe the Endangered Species Act is, let me go back up. The Endangered Species Act was intended to protect species that are in decline, their populations are dropping, and it can protect charismatic species like the whooping crane and the polar bear, and it could also protect. Am I too close to this? I told you it wasn't going to work for me sitting here, so this is evidence of that. It can also protect insects. It doesn't matter the classification of the species. The Endangered Species Act has that kind of reach. And what we've seen historically with the Endangered Species Act in 1973, that more and more species are being protected as their population suffered, as their habitat is threatened. And you can see this trend. The red dot shows the trend of species that are listed as endangered and threatened in the United States. We can break that down into different regions. And a lot of the species that are being listed that affect water issues are primarily fish species. Most of those are located in the West. So it's no surprise we're in the arid West. We have species that are dependent on aquatic ecosystems. As diversions have been occurring to supply water supply to our agricultural users and urban users, that has created conflicts at time. We can even break it down. You can get maps for other states, but you can find out where the endangered species are located, not within a state as a whole, but within a county. And within Texas, we can actually determine where the endangered species are located, and this poses a potential issue in terms of water rights allocation. So just some basics for the Endangered Species Act. I'll cover this quickly. The Endangered Species Act was intended to stop species from going extinct. I've offered this opinion. I think a lot of folks share it that work in environmental law, that it's probably the most powerful environmental law in the U.S. And what it tries to do is protect species, and the course cases and the legislative history on this in terms of striking the balance, when there's a doubt between human needs and listed species needs, usually the listed species needs prevailed. So that's why it's such a powerful law. By legislation, these species have to be protected. The policy behind it is we can talk more about that maybe during the questions about why the Endangered Species Act has such important protections for species. How does it work in general? In order for it to have its regulatory teeth, a species has to be listed. There's a public process for that. Once it's listed, it's protected, and any kind of take of that listed species is prohibited by law. And take is defined broadly. It includes shooting a listed species, but it also includes water project activities that take water away that's necessary for species habitat, or sometimes pumping activities divert species and cause them to be taken out of the river system into the pumps. That's a take. All of that is prohibited if a species is listed. Now, there's a method that will allow lawful activities like water supply activities to go forward even if they're impacted endangered species, but there's a permit process that goes through the federal government. The two federal wildlife agencies, Fish and Wildlife Service and NOAA Fisheries, National Marine Fisheries Service, those two agencies have regulatory authority over fish. So if you have a water agency that's impacting a listed fish, causing a take, in order to continue those water supply activities, those water agencies need to get a permit from the federal government. So how has this all played out? Well, when the Endangered Species Act passed in the 1970s, I don't think they anticipated, I'm pretty sure, that Congress anticipated that it would overlap to such an extent with the state-run water supply allocation in the West. And what has happened is that water users in the West, they can obtain a water right, an appropriative water right, been exercising that water right peacefully for tens of years, and then all of a sudden a species is listed. And then once it's listed, it gets full federal protection. And then the water supply allocation that the water user has been depending on under state law could be superseded by the Endangered Species Act. So the Endangered Species Act can operate as an independent allocation system that can actually change water use. What does this mean in general, to summarize? Well, the Endangered Species Act has provided more water for fish. That's a good thing for the listed species, but has provided less water for agricultural and urban users that were depending on their state-issued water rights. This has caused a lot of tension in terms of property rights. Well, how much tension? Well, first of all, is this just a localized issue in Texas or in California where I've spent most of my time? No. I got a list of significant basins within the West, and I could have added another 12, but I ran out of space, in which a listed species has been protected under the Endangered Species Act, and that listing has affected how water supply is allocated. And so we can go through the list, but you can see it's some of the major tributaries in the West. But there's more. I want to focus on one case study to show the drama. And this is actually the one that has caused the biggest uproar in the United States, and the flames are still fuming. It has to do with two listed fish in California, the Delta Smelt and the Winter Run Salmon. The Delta Smelt, I think it's safe to say among the scientists, this is an abundance graph to the left, I guess it's to the left, is a estimated abundance. This is not population, but it just gives you a feel that in the 1998, when the graph started, things have not been going well. And by 2007, where it ends, and the population has more or less maintained the same since then, the fish abundance has been declining. That's not a good thing for the fish, and it's a protected fish. And what happens is that this fish, I wish I had my pointer here, this fish resides here in the central part of the state, and this is where water is diverted in California from this central delta all over the San Joaquin Valley and down to Southern California, Los Angeles, San Diego. A lot of water is moved in California from the north to the south. Well, as a result of that water movement, there's impacts to these two listed species. The pumps that are pumping the water, they impact the flow of the rivers, and they also impact the individuals of the species as they pass by. So before the application of the Endangered Species Act, all of these water activities in California were regulated by the state. And then in 2008, 2009, the federal government issued biological opinions. And these are the legal documents that give the state agencies and federal agencies the permission to operate their water activities and in a way that even if they impact the fish, they're still legal. Well, these biological opinions caused a big uproar because what they did was they reduced the water supply for farmers and cities in California about 15 to 30% than what they were getting the year before under state law. So this, under state law, there was a water supply that was available, and now under this federal regulation of the Endangered Species Act, there was a big reduction. More water for fish, less for cities, less for industries. The numbers are large. 1.5 million acre feet, that's enough water to supply several million people. Water agencies don't like abrupt changes. It takes years to develop water supply. In 2 years, these water agencies lost about 15 to 30% of their water supply. Immediately, the water agencies went to court. They were able to have these biological opinions invalidated based on scientific reasons. This case is pending by the Ninth Circuit right now. Everybody's watching it because it will be sort of the standard, the gold standard of how the Endangered Species Act is viewed by the courts relating to water. So if my story, and what did this cause, of course, when these water supply reductions occurred? Massive public controversy. My boss at the time, Governor Schwarzenegger, couldn't resist. He got into it as well on long marches trying to restore the water. It was fish versus people fight that was going on, and it's still going on in California and other parts of the West. Okay, my story ended there. Do I have 5 more minutes?
Two
more minutes. Okay. I want to jump into water rights as property because I could end my story there and it'd be a great story. But the story gets richer because now what happens is we've had a water supply reduction due to the Endangered Species Act, and this comes into the question now, what does this mean now for folks that actually believe water isn't a public resource, it's a privately owned resource? And this is water rights as property, and this is where lawyers just love to jump into it. And that is it possible to consider water owned as a private property right? And if so, is it possible for the federal government to reduce it without impacting the private property right to the point that they've taken property? This would be similar to if the federal government wanted to exercise eminent domain and take somebody's property to build a post office. Government has that power, but they have to pay compensation. So if the federal government is regulating water supply to protect fish, do they have to compensate those water agencies because that water right is viewed as a private right? Okay, I'll go through this very quickly. And what this means is that for water, is it public or private? I can't answer that question. It depends on the state and whether it's surface water or groundwater. Texas has a lot of strong principles that protect groundwater more as a private property right than a public property right, but not all states do that. And then the other thing is water users, when they have a right, they really only have a right to use. All rights are limited. They're not full water rights like if you own a car or a house. You have almost full control of that right up to a point. Not the case with water. Water's always had some kind of public component in most states. To determine, though, whether an agency has a private right or a public right over water, one way to approach it is to look at the investment expectations of that water right holder. If they had an anticipation that they were going to control that water right, that cuts more in favor of it being in a private ownership than a public ownership. And then last, I'll leave this, is that as to how we define water depends on each state. Each state has that flexibility. So for states that are more concerned about protecting property rights, they will view water more as a public resource, a private resource, and that will invite more of these taking challenges as water is regulated to protect endangered species. Conversely, if states believe water is a public resource and has environmental components embedded in it, there'll be less of these conflicts. Okay, I'm going to save this question about Texas for later when we get to the discussion. Maybe we can get into that.
The Supreme Court.
Yes, the Supreme Court.
Okay, sounds good. Thanks, David.
You're welcome.
Thank you. My name is Mike McGregor, and I work at High Plains Water Conservation District. I have the privilege of having several people here with me that we work with. Carmen McCain is here. He's our education and public information officer. If you'd raise your hand, Carmen. Melanie Barnes is here. High Plains is the planning agent for 21 county area here in West Texas, and Melanie is on the board, as well as Ken Rainwater on the regional board. I think about the slide Ken had on procrastination, and I was just sitting here thinking that prior to the Americans getting involved with World War II, Winston Churchill said that you can always never doubt the Americans will do the right thing after they have tried everything else. And I think we're sort of at that point, and I feel very strongly that we're at that point here. When I grew up here in Texas, and I was educated here at Texas Tech. I just recently came back to this area. I was away from this immediate area most of my professional life. And when I was growing up here in the 50s, there were about 8 million people in Texas. And our most recent 2010 census has us at about 24 million. So we have the growth dynamic to closing in on us. And then, in my opinion, the strongest uncontrollable factor that we had was the drought in the summer of 2011. We went from procrastination and nuisance and just sort of having this in the back of our mind to where we actually started feeling some pain from it. And if you read the papers, whether you read a Dallas or a Lubbock paper, you'll see the pictures of the dead livestock and places and wildlife where the drought had literally started to bite back. And I was too young to remember the drought of the 50s, but the reservoirs that Ken referred to that are man-made, the results of most of those was from the drought of the 50s. Those were constructed in the late 50s and all the way through the 60s so that we would have the surface supplies adequate to meet our needs. But specifically to the High Plains Water Conservation District, it was the first one created back in 49 or 50. You go through a process with these water conservation districts where they're authorized to be created by the legislature, and then you're on a timetable to have a local election, and then you have a confirmation election forming them and everything. But anyway, High Plains was the first one that was created. And historically, probably from 49 or 50 up until 2000, High Plains pretty well defined what the model was going to be as to the system and what information was going to get captured in it. And that primarily is still used today, even if you go all the way down south. And that's spacing of water wells, measuring static water levels, constructing maps, engaged highly in public education, working in the schools, taking water conservation initiatives from private industry and trying to implement them in your water districts. And so that went on historically, and that's what we have the greatest experience at, because we have 50, 60 years of experience with that. Then chronologically, we had a series of things happen starting in the very late 90s that went up through the mid-2000s, and I won't get into all the bills, but that was Senate Bill 1, Senate Bill 2, Senate Bill 3, and we began to require these regional water planning concepts. And so High Plains is also the regional water planning agency for state regional water planning, and it's 21 counties. It includes most, if you look at the footprint of it, High Plains is the majority of Region O, but we also do the water planning for three or four single county districts to the south of us here. And then finally, the latest evolution and the most recent has been the GMA, or groundwater management process, that we go through. and it has been added in the most recent 5 years. And each water conservation district had to establish what was called a desired future condition. And a desired future condition is a very abstract and concept term that you set, and then you try to define that scientifically. And it can vary from place to place. As Ken indicated to you, the aquifer behavior in Texas is very dramatic. It's very different wherever you go. And so the GMA process allowed some customization of the desired future conditions, where in a karst aquifer they might use spring flows. When the spring flows are cut down or you begin to see those totally disappear, that might be a way of measuring a desired future condition, whereas out here where we have basically have a sand and gravel aquifer, we would define it in another way. And you go to the Gulf Coast, and that aquifer is behaving differently than either one of the others, and so they have a difference. So we came together with the single county districts that are south of us here, and we set our desired future condition in September of 2010, and we are currently dealing with that. Then you can't just set the desired future condition and then hope that it works out. Then you go into a series of rules, rulemaking, a very structured process of hearings and setting up how is it that you're really going to make this become a reality and where the boots are actually going to touch the road and deal with it. And in West Texas, I'm going to say West Texas when I'm the Ogallala portion of West Texas, which is generally the middle of Odessa area all the way up to the top of the panhandle. The footprint of that area, 75 or 80% of it, the desired future condition was set at 50-50, and that meant that whatever the estimated reserves in the ground were in September of 2010, we wanted 50% of those reserves still in place in September of 2060. 50% still there 50 years later. There are some of the other districts that did it differently. They were doing a desired future condition based on the static water level drops, and so they went about it a little bit differently than we did. But the vast majority of the desired future condition in this area is the 50-50. So that's what goes on at High Plains, and High Plains, since it is the oldest water conservation district in Texas, we are highly involved in all three of those processes. You go to the region A above us here, which is the Amarillo area, and the planning agent happens to be the Council of Governments. You go down to region F, which is the area south of us, and the city of San Angelo is the planning agent. So we are in the unique role of being both the planning agent and the regulator and highly involved in the GMA process. And so we really have a comprehensive responsibility here in terms of the area that we're dealing with. In a prior life, I sold water on a retail basis. I was a city manager, professional city manager for 30 years, and I've been doing water conservation work the last 5 or 6 years. And in terms of privatization and the challenges of privatization and whether that's really a feasible alternative or something that can provide a substantial relief to this, it goes back to what's public and what's private that the law professor here mentioned. And the cities that I managed, I continually had vendors that would come to us and say, well, we want to take over your sewage system. We want to take over your water system, and we can do it cheaper, and we can do it better. And I know of two cities that did do that over a period of time, but it's the city has certain permitted requirements. The licensing and staffing of these systems are permitted by the TCEQ. You have bondholders, revenue bondholders, that are obligated. The ratepayer is obligated to service those bonds, and sometimes those are tax-free bonds. Sometimes they're not tax-free bonds. So there's a real mess of trying to privatize these water systems, and literally the municipality or the water district that ran that system and incurred this debt and educated the staff to run it and has the permit from the TCEQ, it's not literally a deal where you just like step out of the chain of title and you just turn it over to a private sector company to run it. There's a lot of pitfalls that can occur. So I was never in a city that we decided to privatize it because I felt like, first of all, if you're going to, you take bids on it, we're, you know, they're generally a public agency, and you take bids on it. And if you're not bidding something in a competitive environment, you generally are not accomplishing anything. So if you bid something and only got one to two bidders, maybe three that are interested, then you may or may not, even from an economic standpoint, be creating any value or benefit because you really don't have a competitive situation. I understand that has changed some. There continues to be evolution of new private sector companies that manage these water systems, and so the competition, if you bid a system today, might be a little better than it was when I quit dealing with it approximately 8 or 9 years ago. But the real challenge is price elasticity. You have these meter charges that are fixed. That's just the basic meter charge. And in an ideal rate model, the meter charge would cover all your fixed costs, your salaries for your meter readers, your billing, everything that goes on month to month that you know you got to pay. Then you have these per thousand or CCF charges that are consumption charges above it. And perfect price elasticity is that if I raise the price of a product 1%, I automatically get 1% reduction in the demand for it. So if a gallon of milk is a dollar and I raise it to a dollar and a nickel, I'm going to get an automatic decrease of 5% in the demand of that product. And I've done quite a bit of research and reading on it, and due to the fact that it is a public and a private commodity both, we've got a long way to go to know how we're going to deal with pricing and the elasticity of the pricing. Some cities I see have gone from $4 or $5 a thousand all the way to 20, which is a fourfold increase, to get a 15% decrease in consumption. That'll give you an idea how disproportionate the elasticity is for it. And it can vary even from community to community because there's an affordability factor. You go to a place like Highland Park or a very affluent community, and, you know, a $500 water bill, they think nothing about it. And you go to a rural area, which is the demographics are a lot different, and the per capita income is lower, and the affordability for water there is not the same that it is in a place like Highland Park or more affluent community. So we haven't ever really defined what is affordability. Is it 2 or 3% of our gross income is affordable water? It's, in my opinion, and I feel very strongly, it's no longer acceptable that affordable water is just the cheapest I can get it. We have since developed our cheapest and close-in water sources. Virtually all the communities have done that, and we're now into the source water that's going to be more expensive, the desalinization. We're hauling it great distances. Even here in the city of Lubbock, this latest acquisition of the Boone Pickens water is going to have to be transported some 160 miles down here for use. So you have water quality and transportation issues that are affecting all this. So it gets to be very, very complex, and every situation is not the same, just like each aquifer is not the same. You can go into each community and you're going to get a different reaction to a price increase. So where are we at on our time here? Okay, well, I made my major points, and I wanted to apologize for not having the overheads. I'd been out of the country and on vacation for about 10 or 11 days, and I got hung up in the airports, and I got in here at 1 a.m. Wednesday, actually 1 a.m. Thursday, and I didn't get into my emails until yesterday morning about 10, so I didn't come here really highly prepared with overheads, but 80% of what I would show you in the overheads have already been shown to you by Ken and David.
Thanks, Mike. I just want to get into want to piggyback on one thing that Mike just said about privatizing municipal water systems, and we can go to some Q&A from the audience. But I'm from Missoula. There's a couple other folks here from Missoula. And one thing that's happened there is that the Carlyle Group, which is a massive global equity firm, just acquired Missoula's private water utility. They did so by acquiring a company called Park Water Company, based in California, that owned Mountain Water Company. And I'm curious the extent to which this is happening across the country, where these large multinationals are coming in and acquiring municipal, perhaps cash-strapped water systems around the country.
I can take a shot at it. I think it's a popular idea. You've got local governments that are struggling all across the country, most of them, and if they can find a way to pass on their water responsibility to someone else, they might see that as a win. You've got these companies that, when they make their presentations, they can do. They think they can deliver the product at a cheaper price, the water supply at the cheaper price. So you've got a private entity that's taking over the responsibility for delivering water. One thing I want to clarify, though, that doesn't mean that they own the water rights. Those are still held typically by the public agency, but the responsibility to pump the water, purify the water, and deliver it, that's now been transferred to a private company. The other thing that I would point out is that the rates are still typically managed by either that public agency or by a utility commission for each state. It's not as if, because they have a natural monopoly, they can charge whatever they want. Now, they're going to try to make a profit out of it, so that could cause the rates to go up. But there still would be some price control typically. There's a good report that's been put out by the Pacific Institute. You can get it online. And they've done an extensive study relating to private companies attempting to take over responsibilities for water delivery. And they, I believe, come to the conclusion that the price benefits that were sought by the government agencies making the transfer usually don't materialize.
Yeah, let's open it up to questions from the audience.
Yes.
Do you have any advice for journalists that are looking at that side of that point?
Sure. The question, as I understand it, is you have these private companies that deliver bottled water, and they're buying water rights or obtaining water rights, and then they use those water rights to fill the bottles and then deliver the water all over, either outside the state or internationally. So actually, this is a good time to get in the case, because that was the exact situation in Texas about 10 years ago, where the bottling company here, Ozarka, had decided that it would end up and sink some wells near a property owner. And the question was, for the course of debate, because of the wells that they were sinking to take groundwater and put it into bottles, it was impacting the neighbors. Neighbors didn't like it. In other words, their wells were dropping because the bottling company was taking water to put it into the bottles. This becomes a question of water rights for each state. And because Texas has this rule of capture, which is the most pro-property rights approach to any state, so whenever somebody owns property in Texas, they have a right to the groundwater underneath it, and they can pump it, even if that pumping damages the neighbor. Other states don't have, if it's groundwater, don't have that same rule. They generally factor in the impact to the adjoining landowners. So that's one possibility, is to take a look at the consequences to the neighbors. There's also the environmental consequences that are associated with this, you know, whether it's subsidence or impacts on the surface. That's another angle that gets litigated with this issue and some policy. And the same way on the surface water side, the surface water rights system is different than the groundwater system for each state. All the western states allow for the potential of these kind of bottling companies, because they all honor this appropriative system, which says that you can take water and deliver it anywhere you want as long as you comply with the permit. So that's the other possibilities to see the permitting side of it. I don't know.
I just want to add one thing about the Missoula example. So there's a very influential nonprofit called the Clark Fork Coalition in Missoula, and they were heavily involved in negotiating this deal with the Carlisle Group, and they actually got Carlisle to sign an agreement that said that they could not take any of the water out of the aquifer to sell it to other markets. And so I think that applies here.
Beware of numbers, too, because 5 million gallons in Seattle, when the city may be consuming 400 or 500 million gallons a day. Excuse me. I thought I'd turn that down. And the city, may be consuming 100-time multiple of that. And then you've got agricultural producers that are using a multiple similar to that. And you say, well, that's local. Well, no, it really isn't, because if I'm growing peanuts that I sell in China, all I'm doing is selling my water to China. So there's relativity to it when you say Nestle is going to do this 5 million gallons a day. Well, what is that in relation to everything going on around it? It may end up being not even 1% of the water being pumped in that area. I don't know what your numbers are, but, if you're going to research this, you have to have some relativity to this water use, the amount and the type of use versus what's going on in that area.
So the question's about drawdown versus recharge ratio?
Yeah. Yeah. The question is, do you want me to repeat the question again?
Sure.
The question is the 50-50 desired future condition, what in reality is that going to mean between now and the end of the 50-year period? Is that what you're referring to? Is no, I don't think the 50-year period will come in 10 years. But the fact of the matter is, it's just like these rainwater numbers or rain measurements that Dr. Rainwater gave us. I wasn't doing that properly. That's an unknown factor. We may have years where we push the desired future condition, may have multiple years where we push the desired future condition due to drought, and then we may have years due to high rainfall that we make that up. So it's not something that's in a vacuum, and it's just a unit every year. We're gonna see, movement of that each year. The only objective is to get to the end of the 50-year period and do that. And Dr. Rainwater's suggesting the bank account. You can't explain it any better than that.
Well, what I would encourage you to think about, if you're going to describe a bank and how the bank is doing, the bank is the sum of all the people who have accounts in the bank. Here in the Ogallala, some of the people started off with more water available. If they are taking the water out faster than it was recharged, they will get below a point where they can physically produce the water with our pumping machines faster than someone who started off with twice as much saturated thickness. So I guess that's why I wanted to demonstrate that the fact that the aquifer has different saturated thicknesses in different places. A lot of the, and Mike can speak more to this, a lot of these calculations for the region or a groundwater management area in terms of the 50-50 are broad numbers based on how those numbers have to be related. But each landowner has their own chance to manage their own water based on understanding their saturated thickness, their application rates, their crop choices. Do they plan to just use it just to pre-irrigate to get their seeds to germinate and go dry land the rest of the year, or are they going to raise something that requires more water? So each person has their own bank account. They don't have much control over the deposits, but they sure know how big the checks are.
Seems to me you guys have switched the analogy.
Amen.
I don't disagree with that. In the final analysis, we're relying on a local and a regional model here to do this. I can't explain it any more simple than that. And then, so.
Let's take just two more questions. We're kind of short on time here.
Well, we have done, if you've heard Professor Hayhoe talk here, you probably heard some about that stuff in that region. Some of the research we've done here, it looks like the rainfall that we had from 1990 to 2010, if you look at all the average annual for that 20-year period, was about 10% less than the rainfall for 1970 to 1990, for example. So there are some changes in the amount of precipitation that we see in that form that are noticed in the data. Well, there's still, you know, there's more to it than just those numbers about the annual average rainfall. There's also when does it fall? You know, you'd like to start off each new growing season with some soil moisture to help your seeds germinate and start the process. If that's not there naturally, you either have to supplement it or things won't go as well, or it affects your period in the growing season. So that, those sort of risks are always going to be there, even if the average rainfall had stayed the same. We don't always get the rainfall at the same time each year. This being here in the middle of the continent, we're a lot more random than perhaps some of our coastal environments.
Yeah, well, as the gray wolf listing, I haven't been tracking that closely, but I understand it's now been delisted because of the population successes. So that was considered a good news story in general, but there's still protections for the species. It's not through the Endangered Species Act, if I understood your question correctly. Oh, I see. Yeah, I see. Yeah. Well, to the extent there's a lot of political involvement in the Endangered Species Act, yeah, absolutely. I've been tracking that very well. There was an effort to change the status of the Endangered Species Act as it was applied to these fish in California to actually write an exemption to the Endangered Species Act so that way these water supply reductions wouldn't occur. That legislation didn't pass, and that's a concern for any kind of statute that has this kind of teeth, that if it is applied in a way that's going to cause some consternation from a powerful group of people, they're going to go to Congress and see if they can get some help. I will say historically, the efforts to try to soften the Endangered Species Act have generally failed politically.
Help me understand the word NGO?
Non-government organizations.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, she was asking for developing nations that are trying to deal with water contamination issues and water supply issues. Are there recommendations we could have maybe based on lessons learned for non-government organizations that are trying to assist at this moment?
Well, at High Plains, we use some private vendors that helps us with our printed material as well as some of the water conservation programs, Save Water, Water IQ, these things. We employ those sort of things, but I don't know if that's really answering your question or not.
Yeah, just one thing I've heard people that work with, I guess, in the water charity type business, things like that, is as you work with different NGOs, just make sure you watch them carefully to make sure that they have a track record for putting in systems that work and stay working. If you're going to try something new in an area where it hasn't been used before, the people have to take ownership and be able to operate it when the people that came from out of town leave. And I've not done that personally. I've just heard from people like Michael Campan and other folks like that that are involved in some of these water charities that we have to be careful that we do right by the people we're trying to help. One, to sell the technology to the folks, and then two, hopefully it'll be done well enough that then their local government, state, federal, province, whatever it is, will want to pick it up and spread it to do good by the rest.
We have to end it there, I think. We're already 7 minutes overdue. I got strict orders to stop 7 minutes ago that I ignored. So thank you very much to the panelists.